Good morning. Always an honor to worship with you. We're grateful for your presence today and for your encouragement always. Thanks for everyone who's led us so far in our worship and for your leader or fellowship in the worship today. The portrait of the gentleman on the screen is named Author John Gossip. I have always felt very sorry for him. He is a Scottish preacher of the late 1800s, well, really in the early 1900s. He died in the early 50s. He was the preacher at Aberdeen, Scotland, which is on the northeast coast of Scotland. That's way up there on the North Sea, coastal city. And the story about Gossip that has made him famous as far as the preaching world is that in 1927, at the age of 54, he unexpectedly, suddenly, shockingly lost his wife. And he, of course, as a result, was lost himself. I know that everyone depends upon their mates for making it through life and everything. That is especially true in ministry. And by the way, when I refer to ministry, I refer to far more things than pulpit preaching or church work. There are many of you in professions that are servants in a ministry kind of profession, and we're grateful for you. But Gossip's most famous sermon, the one for which he is remembered, was preached the very next Sunday after her funeral. He was at the height of really his health. He was at the height of his reputation, popularity, all those kinds of things. But he was absolutely lost. And so he took a passage from Jeremiah 12 in verse 7. That says, if you're going to complain about the critters, as I would call them, out on the desert, what are you going to do when you get into the jungle with all the creatures that are there? And if you're going to complain about fighting foot soldiers, what are you going to do when the soldiers on horses come? And he titled that lesson, Sharing with the Congregation His Heart and deep soul, not necessarily doing what we're doing today, dealing with the story briefly of Job, but he asked this question. When life tumbles in, what then? He acknowledged that already he knew, of course, the message of Scripture, but there was the temptation to look in more places. And so he looked in philosophy, and he looked in theology, and he looked in poetry, and he looked in novels and all of that kind of thing. But he came to the conclusion that when things like this happen, which is true of all of us at any time when crisis appears, that if you do not have the Bible, if you do not have the God of the Bible, if you do not have the Savior of the Bible, you have absolutely nothing at all. You could add to that, if you did not have the hope of heaven when this life is over, you have nothing at all. So this sermon and the contents of it have been studied a lot down through the years in seminaries and graduate schools and theological schools. Much like Jonathan Edwards of the early colonial days, sinners in the hands of an angry God, because it is believed that Gossip is able to go in the midst of his heartbreak, is able to put words to page, perhaps better than had been done before or even perhaps since. We're basing this lesson on the story of Job. Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth? I have shared with you before an observation from Bible study that the Bible does not spend a great deal of time complimenting. It just tells it like it is. It does not spend a great deal of time condemning either. If there's a condemnation that is appropriate, it tells it like it is. What it does is tell in very few words whatever it's dealing with, and very straightforward, what the will and the words of God really is and are. And so, as we look today at the story of Job, and you look in chapter 1, we're going to look first of all at his traits. You heard Gary read very well a few moments ago that Job was a righteous man, blameless, upright, shunning evil, fearing God. And that's especially impressive because he was a rich man. No one was blessed more than he in terms of cattle and lambs and oxen and camels and donkeys. And also there's reference to the many servants that he had. Perhaps he wasn't even aware of all the servants that he had in his employ. Actually, would have owned. And so he was the wealthiest man, in fact, described as there was no one greater in the East. And what that refers to is there was no one who was greater blessed. But he was also a religious man. We saw in verses 4 and 5 how that he was worried, as every good parent and godly parent does. He was worried about his 7 sons and 3 daughters, because they occasionally get together to celebrate a feast or to celebrate a festival, and perhaps sometimes it would turn into a party in which they consume too much. And so he made sacrifices the day following these festivals of burnt offerings, saying, you know, what if my children have sinned against the Lord? Now we know that no parent can make up for the sins of their children, nor can children make up for the sins of their parents. But what it shows is a godly man, a holy man, a righteous man. I love it when God commends him to Satan and says, there is none like him in all the face of the earth. That is a supreme compliment, and said only of Job from the voice of God, not from a fellow Bible character, but from the voice of God. But Satan's not content with that, so he comes along and he challenges God by challenging Job with absolutely no explanation throughout the story until the end of why he's experiencing what he does. So secondly, there's the trials of Job. We're just doing a brief survey here of a marvelous book. I pause just to say something personal here about the fall of 1989. Actually, it was the spring and the summer of 1989 when in the Bible department we were putting together the curriculum for our very first graduate program in Bible called the Master of Ministry. And I remember one of the most popular courses, if not the most popular, was a seminar taught by our beloved Clyde on Job. Clyde, I've thought a lot about how many students over those years in a graduate level went through that marvelous book. 42 chapters. It's one of our poetical books, written mostly in poetry, although telling a fabulous story. And this month, in October, we're looking at poetical literature for the basis of our studies, so that's why Job. What were the trials? First of all, Job loses everything. The loss of property and personnel, as he receives 4 messages. The Sabaeans have done this, and fire from heaven has killed this, and the Chaldeans came along and they robbed this. And then of all things, the 4th messenger, just like that, one right after another, a great wind came out of the east and hit the house where all 7 of your sons and all 3 of your daughters were together, and they have all perished. You know, there's some people, even at the scholarly level, who would tell you that Job cannot be a real story. It has to be a fable. It has to be fantasy. It has to be the imagination of a very good writer in the Old Testament, because no one I mean, come on. No one could lose 10 children at one time, right? We know better here, don't we? And there have been many cases of tornadoes wiping out an entire family. One not many years ago in Bradford, 40 miles away, and they were members of the church. And the husband in that home, his father was the funeral director of that town and had to bury his son, daughter-in-law, and their children. Don't tell me that Job is not as real as life itself. God says, there was a man in Uz whose name was Job, and it is attested to none other than by those in the New Testament as well. Job also had the loss of family. I know that it's hard for us to believe such a tragedy, but we do believe it. And we have seen it and felt it. And then there's the loss of health. Chapter 2, after God commends Job to Satan, said, I told you that I allow you to do all these things to my servant Job, and he will be faithful to me. And Job was, through all these losses first, because God had told Satan, you cannot touch his skin, you cannot touch his life. And so the next challenge was, you let me touch his skin. All that a man has, he will give up for his life. And God said to Satan, then you may touch his skin, but you cannot take his life. And so all of a sudden, here comes this hideous collection of sores from the top of the head to the bottom of the feet that, quite frankly, were embarrassing. And people would see Job and pass Job and wag their heads in unbelief, disbelief. Here is the greatest man they've ever known. Here is a righteous man. Here is a wealthy man. Here is a man who had it all, who has lost it all. And yet he still maintains his faith and belief in a God who has given him no hint as to why. And then, bless her heart, I think sometimes we're hard on the wife of Job, who we just refer to as Sister Job. You know, she too lost 10 children that she gave birth to, she carried, gave birth to, nursed, raised. And so you can understand from the human perspective why in verse 9 of chapter 2 that she would cry out, Job, why don't you just curse God and die? In other words, being in your situation, it would be better to be dead than what you're having to live with, because there was no cure for those sores that she thought was going to be on his body for the rest of his life. One of the remarkable statements about the faith of Job is what he says in response to her. Would that all husbands could be this wise in response, and all wives be in response to statements made by husbands. He says, you speak as one of the foolish women. Now, he is not calling her a fool, but he is describing foolish women who, basically in the Old Testament, the idea of a fool refers to one who does not believe or acknowledge God, the God of heaven. How can we accept all the blessings of God, he says, and not accept adversity? Or how can we accept prosperity without accepting adversity? You see, you and I are all about the expectation of life being great and grand and wonderful all the time, right? Because most of the time it is. What we don't understand is why we're blessed. What we don't understand even more is why that we have life's experiences. And so with great faith and fortitude, he continues to sit in sackcloth and ashes, scratching himself, scratching these sores and people just saying, basically, unbelievable. However, Job had the last word. Now, if you read from chapter 3 through chapter 7, you're going to have a series of fantastic speeches on the part of Job, and really Job questions God. He doesn't remain silent. He is provoked after 7 days of silence when so-called friends show up, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. They show up to counsel him and basically are using the retribution theory and accusing him of sin by saying, look, Job, things like this don't happen to a righteous man. Things like this don't happen to a good man. They certainly do not happen to a godly man. You have got something in your life that only God knows, no one else knows, and you have not repented of it nor confessed it. And so it goes on and on. And speech after speech, including by a younger man later by the name of Elihu, they all think they have the answer and they have no answer at all. In fact, God has a special condemnation, or at least a recommendation, for those three first speakers in chapter 42. But Job asked some difficult questions along the way in his defense. If all of this had to happen to me, why was I even born? If all of this had to happen to me, having been born, why could I not have died as soon as my mother gave birth? And where is my God in the midst of all of this? If he will come forth, I will come forth as gold. In other words, if he will appear, I welcome the complete examination of my life. The familiar statement in chapter 13, verse 15, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. That has inspired generations, centuries of saints, and it should inspire us today. As we draw closer to the time of the Lord's return, closer to the time of judgment, closer to the time of going home, trusting in him more, though he slay me. Man. Again, the only time in Scripture that we find a statement just like that. Really, on a human level, you could say that there is no one like Job. Many, many good people. But God was right when he's describing him. And he proves it, you see, in the laboratory of life, in the arena of real living, because all of this really happened. You could even call those boils or sores or whatever they were a terminal illness, at least it was believed at the time. But in all these things, Job did not sin, the text says. Nor, get this, did he blame God. Again, Job was provoked to ask those questions because of the accusations that were being made against him by these counselors that were not. They didn't know what they were talking about. So finally, in chapter 38, the presence of God appears. And from chapter 38 through 40, with Job not saying a word in response, he listens as we should. And God answers him with a series of questions, chapters 38 to 41, because at the beginning of 41, Job does confess the fact that he has questioned God, and he repents, he says, in sackcloth and ashes, and he is not going to speak again. That is to say, God continues speaking. I am not going to say another word because you are right and I am wrong. But here are the questions. I mean, we don't have time for all of them. 40, more than 40 or so. And it's beautiful language about the nature of God, about the description of God, about the wisdom of God, power of God, omnipresence, omnipotence, omniscience, all of that. No limit to him. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? 38 verse 2. Gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me. And basically, one right after another, going through the heavens and all the earth, the sea, the weather, the hippopotamus, the crocodile, and all kinds of things in terms of creation. Here is the summary question at the very beginning, what our English teachers would say. Here's the thesis statement at the beginning of the paragraph. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? I was here. God is saying, I was here. Where were you? And therefore, since you do not know its measurements, and since you do not know the line that I have placed within the earth, and because you do not know the pathways of the sea and all things like that, how can you possibly know what is happening here? And so when our experiment, not really experiment, but test of faith is over, chapter 42, verse 6, Job expresses genuine sorrow. He's not doubted God. That's not the point. But he allowed these friends to provoke him to question God. Would you not say that that appears to be a right and normal thing to do, to question God when you don't understand what's going on around you? The point of the lesson is that we're in pretty good company when we do that, although we all always to live in penitence, even when we express sometimes what we feel but we do not understand. In fact, on these three ideas, pardon me, about sorrow, worship, there are passages in chapter 42 about all of them, profound faith. I want to go back to chapter 1, Job's response initially to all of these challenges. In verse 20, after hearing about the death of his 10 children, chapter 1, verse 20, Job arose and tore his robe, which was an outward expression, nonverbal communication of indescribable anguish. He shaved his head. He fell to the ground and worshiped. He said, "Naked came I from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord has given, and the Lord has taken away." Now, the telling of that statement is inspired. The Lord had not taken away anything. He had allowed Satan to take away everything, and that's the key to understanding the book, the activity of evil and Satan in the world, the consequences of it. But our God has never changed. He's never moved. And he is the solution to whatever the problem. "Blessed be the name of the Lord," he says. Through all of this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. So he expresses sorrow, he worships the Lord, and then he reveals profound faith. Here are some lessons very quickly that we need to remember that Job teaches us. We've already noted verse 22, undeserved suffering happens to the righteous as well as the unrighteous. Jesus reminds us, God sends the sunshine and the rain on both the righteous and the unrighteous. What that means is we are not in some protective bubble when we're baptized into Christ. We certainly are spiritually. But we still live in a very physical, material world where there is the consequence of sinfulness. All of those centuries before us, including our own time, we have contributed to it too. But our sorrow and suffering does not necessarily occur because of our own secret acts of sin. It's because there's evil in the world. And a result of evil in the world is there's sickness in the world. And when there's sickness in the world, there's suffering in the world. And when there's suffering in the world, there's dying in the world. God was not inventing death in Genesis chapter 1. He created life. Death is introduced as a consequence of the appearance of Satan, the evil one. So we've got to remember that we're both blessed. regardless of how little or much that we are, we're blessed, but we also are subject to all the diseases and all the events of mankind. God is the source and sustainer of all that we have. I'd like to encourage you to read again, if you haven't in a while, these four chapters in particular, and really the chapter of triumph, chapter 42, where Job is going to be restored twice as much as he had before, twice as many camels, twice as many oxen, twice as many donkeys, all measures of wealth that he could have twice as much. I had a student to observe one time, one thing the Lord blessed Job with, he only gave him 10 more children instead of 20. 7 more sons and 3 more daughters. And yes, I firmly believe those were new children, not raised from the dead, the previous ones, 7 more. The daughters are given names in chapter 42, and they're described as the fairest in all the land. God is the source and the sustainer of all we have. And by the way, he tells those 3 friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and so forth, you go to my servant Job. Over and over and over, he doesn't just say Job, my servant Job, my servant Job, my servant Job. He is, you're not. So God is going to take care of us. I referred to those 4 chapters, 38, 39, 40, and 41. If someone can read that, and especially those of you from scientific and physics and biological and chemical backgrounds and astronomy and all of that, the things that are mentioned there from the work of God's creation, we really have no section like it in the Bible. We have the claim of the Bible. But God himself is specifying, I did this, I did this, I did this, I did this, I did this. Where were you? Now there is where you get an idea of what it's like to be the created, and there's only one creator, and he sustains us no matter what. Our trials are designed to draw us closer to him. Do you think Jesus could possibly be closer to God the Father than he was when he went into the Garden of Gethsemane, and then he went there, from there to the cross? You know? If possible, I believe the burden of your sin and mine was so much upon him in Gethsemane that yes, he had never been closer to his Father, at least while he was upon the earth. And then as he had to struggle for every breath upon the cross, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit, and dies. You see, when we are free from trials, and some have more than others, life's not fair. It's never been fair since chapter 3 of Genesis. Some have less than others, but we all have them. It makes us stop whatever we're doing, and if we're not accustomed to really believing God, really praying to God, really searching his word, and trying to live the life of faith, we'll just go on our merry way and continue prospering. I close with a couple of statements from that sermon by Arthur Gossop. I said at the beginning, I feel sorry for him. Imagine a preacher, his whole life, 50, 60 year career, being named Gossop. But I'm grateful to him for these statements. You people in the sunshine, in other words, those of you who have no problems right now, may believe the faith, but we in the shadow must believe it because we have nothing else. I don't think you need to be afraid of life. Our hearts are very frail. There are places where the road is very steep and lonely, but we have a wonderful God. The first Sunday following the funeral, of his wife, who was in the middle and height of her life too. Busy as a preacher's wife. And so as we think about those who have been there, we appreciate the lessons that we can learn from lives gone before us. That was stated in 1927. Gossett would live till the early 1950s. So today we want to be encouraged by the words of ancient words, in our estimation, 3,000 or so years ago, ancient words of wisdom in poetic form that reveal to us not just the message of God, but the God of the message. And it is to him today that we invite you and we encourage you to become his child by being baptized into him, or to renew your faith as his child and thrust your cares upon him while we stand and sing.